On WHVW Hyde Park, where it is 12 noon, Scott is in the studio. He's in the building, as they say, and he's got a presidential brainiac. I guess you can't have any Elvis questions on presidential brainiac. Thankfully, Elvis was never president, although he probably could have done a better job than the guys in the house. That's another thing.
All right. So, yes, we do. We have a wonderful show today, and this is your host, Rotarian Scott Meyer, speaking to you from New York's beautiful Hudson Valley in Rotary District 7210, where all these past shows this past year are archived on Rotary District 7210's website. So all you have to do is put that in any one of the search engines. It'll come up, and you can click on the different shows and listen to them again.
You know that Elvis died, you know, was it 30-some-odd years ago?
Is that, was yes, Elvis yes, Sally's last goat?
No, Elvis, you know. You remember Elvis? Died on the 17th.
Today?
Yeah, no, it was the 16th or the 17th of August that he died on.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Back in 1977.
I did not know that.
Not really.
Rotarians know a lot of things, but that was one thing I didn't know.
Yeah, well, I don't really know if he's dead. I just saw him on the main mall, so.
Okay, well, we do have a fantastic show for you, whether Elvis is in the building or not. So, first guest is Dr. Gary Lovett, who is a senior scientist at the Carey Institute in Millbrook, New York. And as I mentioned in the pre-show, we are going to talk about threats from above, air pollution impacts, ecosystem and biological diversity in the eastern United States. This was a project that was funded and research done with in conjunction with the Nature Conservancy and the Carey Institute, and the paper was published in June of 2008. Am I correct on all those?
That is right.
All right. So Dr. Gary Lovett, hereafter we're going to say Gary, or hey you, what is this study that you did with the Nature Conservancy?
Well, as you said, this is a cooperative effort between the Carey Institute and the Nature Conservancy. You know, most people, most of the listeners, I'm sure, know the Nature Conservancy. They're the nation's largest conservation organization, and they mostly do their work by buying land. They protect land. But they realize that they can't really protect the species that they want to protect just by buying the land, because there are threats that don't recognize property boundaries, like air pollution. And so they've gotten involved in the air pollution debate, and we put together this report that assesses for them how what the effects of air pollution on species throughout the eastern U.S. And what we found was that nearly all the different ecosystem types in the eastern U.S. are affected by one or more of the air pollutants that we looked at.
And what, how many, what was this, a team of scientists, or what kind of, what were the numbers of people doing this research?
Right, we started out with a workshop that involved about 35 scientists from the Nature Conservancy and the Carey Institute and other places. And then we narrowed down to a group of about five or six of us that actually put this report together.
And you did this evaluation all over the Northeast?
Right, we were looking at the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states. And we looked at four different air pollutants. One is acid rain, and the two components of acid rain, sulfur and nitrogen. Another one is ozone, which is a component of urban smog. And the last one is mercury, which is a pollutant that comes out of coal-burning power plants. And it pollutes waterways. People have probably heard about it in terms of contamination of fish.
Do they? So you're studying all these different pollutants. Is one more harmful to us than others, or is there one we should really, really be worried about? Or?
Well, they're all harmful in different ways, and we were looking mostly at effects on ecosystems, and that's one of our main points, actually. It's a good point to bring up, is that the regulations for air pollution in the U.S. are primarily based on human health, and that's a good thing, but we think they need to go beyond that and make regulations that serve to protect ecosystem health as well. So ecosystems are damaged by different pollutants and different forms of pollutants than humans are, and so we need regulations that protect both.
So even though it's titled Threats from Above, you're studying the whole ecosystem, the water, the soil, the trees, everything.
Right, and we are looking at effects on all sorts of different species, birds, amphibians, fish, mammals. We looked at a number of different ecosystem types too, including forests and lakes and streams and estuaries. So we tried to keep the focus as broad as possible.
How long a term study is this still going on, or is it?
Well, we finished the study part of it. The workshop was back in 2004, so it's really been 4 years in collecting all the data and summarizing it this way. And now we're more into I guess you'd call it a government relations part of this, where we're trying to get the federal government interested in protecting ecosystems as part of the national legislation on air pollution. So we've been down in Washington. We're talking to legislators and their staffs about how to approach this from a federal legislation point of view.
And you've already started to do that?
Yes.
And how? What kind of success? Or?
Well, we find everybody very interested in it, but the climate for environmental regulations in Washington at the moment is not very good. We're all looking forward to 2009 where things might improve.
Anytime there's an election year, there's always that situation.
Right.
So of these, let's discuss a little bit deeper on some of the different, the five different pollutants that you were talking about.
Okay. There's the first one I talked about was acid rain, and there's really two components of that. One is sulfur that primarily comes from these Midwestern coal-fired power plants that we've all heard about. So the power plants burn coal, they release the sulfur in the air, and it blows downwind, and it deposits on us here in the Hudson Valley. It deposits on the Adirondacks and the Green Mountains and so forth. And that can hurt forests by stripping nutrients out of the forest, but it can also acidify lakes and kill fish in lakes. And then there's ozone, which is a component of urban smog, and that's a pollutant that is specifically damaging to human lungs, but it also damages plants. They don't photosynthesize as well when they've got ozone around. In fact, they've done studies to look at crop damage, and there's $3 to $6 billion a year of crop damage just due to ozone. We looked at nitrogen, which is a pollutant that not only contributes to acid rain, but it causes overgrowth of algae in estuaries and rivers and so forth, like the Hudson River and Long Island Sound. And that overgrowth of algae leads to depletion of oxygen, and that kills fish. And that's really hurt the fishing and shell fishing, especially in all the East Coast estuaries, but especially Chesapeake Bay. And then the last one is mercury that we talked about. That also comes out of coal burning. It gets into food webs, and it what we call it bioaccumulation in food web. So as you go further and further up the food web, it gets more concentrated. And so animals that eat at the top of the food web, like humans or like birds, like eagles, that loons that eat fish, are subject to mercury contamination, and that causes neurological problems.
In this age of trying to increase our energy, there's a lot of talk about increasing coal burning. So is that part of your study to say, well, you know, if we increase coal burning, the rate of all these pollutants will go up X amount?
Well, coal is the dirtiest of the fossil fuels that we have, so we really have to be careful if we're going to increase coal burning. I certainly wouldn't be in favor of that. I think there are other ways to get our energy. Now, if you're careful with coal burning, you can get these pollutants out of it. You can take out the sulfur emissions and the nitrogen emissions, but it's fairly expensive, and so it would increase the cost of the coal burning and maybe make coal more on a par with the other energy sources.
But by increasing that cost, it probably decreases cost because of what you would have to do because of the pollutants being there. You have to clean them, you have to, your health, and all the different other things that happen because you have pollutants, right?
Excellent point. If you look at the total cost of burning these fossil fuels, it includes all the environmental impacts and the health impacts of the pollution that's generated.
So and actually, if you do the cleaning of the coal, get a cleaner coal, it actually helps and lowers the cost in the long run.
Yes, they've shown it's difficult to quantify the environmental cost, but the health costs are more easy to quantify. And the ratio of cost to benefit in terms of reducing the pollution load from these air pollutants that we generate is something like 10 to 1. There's a huge benefit of increasing the or decreasing the pollution that's emitted because of the benefits to human health.
And so by showing what's happening to our human health, that'll let the government act more swiftly than if you said the coyotes are.
Right. They tend to focus more on human health, and I guess that's done with good reason. But because the ecosystems respond to different forms of these pollutants, I think there's reason to ask for regulations that protect ecosystem health also.
What kind of regulations are in place now that can be enhanced?
Yeah, so they have the regulations that are in place now look at the concentrations of these pollutants in the air because that's what we breathe in. But what ecosystems respond to is how much of the pollutant lands on the surface, either on the trees or on the lakes or whatever the ecosystem is you're looking at. And so you have to restructure the pollutant regulations a little bit to account for that also, and that's what we're asking them to do.
So you're asking them to reevaluate existing guidelines already and to change them in a little ways?
Yes, to change the focus so that we're not only protecting human health, but protecting ecosystem health as well. And we're also asking, we don't really have a good monitoring program so that we can assess the impact of these pollutants on natural resources, and we need to beef up the monitoring programs because there's big gaps in the way we monitor now.
So I would think that even though you're asking for, you know, beefing up the monitoring system, which will cost money, and changing the regulations, it's not like they're putting a whole new bill through. They're just, you know, looking at the language of that particular line item or something and adding a couple of words. And that will, in the long run, decrease the cost. So it's like doing geothermal. If a school's putting in geothermal energy source, but the voters vote it down because it's too expensive up front. In the long run, it's a better to do it, but you have to convince the people that it's better to do it now. How do you do that?
Yeah, I don't think it's too difficult to sell. I think most people appreciate the value of reducing pollution, both for their own health and for protecting the ecosystems that they live in and care about. And I think it's easy to sell it also on the basis of good government. If we're spending a lot of money reducing pollution, which we are already, we need to track how effective those pollution regulations are, or we don't know if we're spending our money well.
This report that you've done, the threats from above, is this available for anybody to look at? Is it can you download it from the Cary Institute website, for
yes,
example?
Yes, if you get on the Cary Institute website, it's www.ecostudies.org. There's a banner there right now that can take you directly to this report. It's called Threats from Above, and you can get a PDF copy of it that way.
And do you think that it's, 30-some-odd pages long? Do you think that government officials are going to read it, or are they going to... Did you summarize it in like a couple of paragraphs or bullet points?
No, I don't really expect that government officials are going to read it, unfortunately. But they can use it as a reference, and they use it to wave around and say, see, this is a problem. but some people will read it. Some of the staffers will read it. And we did summarize it in an executive summary, which is about 2 pages in the beginning, and hopefully some people will read that. The last 2 pages are a call to action. So that's what we're asking the government to do. And that has to do with the changing the structure of the regulations and beefing up the monitoring.
So you're actually giving some solutions in the report as well as doing. Okay, that is great. So that's Dr. Gary Lovett, and I'm your host, Scott Meyer, and we're going to take a break for Rotary International's Word of the Day.
What can you do as a member of Rotary? You can eradicate polio. You can promote peace. You can feed the hungry. You can help children do better in school. Whether it's helping to eliminate a dreaded disease, volunteering at a food bank, or equipping a school library, Rotary is people who know that by working together, you can do anything. Learn more at Rotary.org. Rotary, humanity in motion.
Okay. Scott?
I'm back. I was fascinated by Gary's talk.
Oh, no, keep him on. He's great.
Well, maybe we'll have him back. we're talking to Dr. Gary Lovett and his new report, Threats from Above, which he did with 32 other scientists and people of interest. And you can go to the Cary Institute website and download it as a PDF to read it. And you can only, if you don't want to read all 35 pages or 30, how many pages there are, you can read the executive summary, which is the first 2 pages after the title page. So thank you very much, Gary. That was a great talk.
Glad to be here.
And I'm sure we'll have you back to talk more. But right now, we have with us Emma Lovett and Janet Allison. Now, Janet Allison, a number of years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, started a thing called, which we call the Junior Interact. And I think Rotary calls them Early Act. But we call it Junior Interact because we started before there was an Early Act. Now, Emma was one of the first people to be in that Junior Interact. She's now in 8th grade, and she joined when she was in 3rd grade. So first we're going to explore a little bit about Emma and find out who she is and where she's going to be. So Emma, you're in 8th grade, is that correct?
That's correct.
And do you know what service learning or community service is?
Yes.
And can you define it for me? Pretend I have no clue.
Well, community service is the helping and bettering of your community and what's around you and trying for your whole town to benefit.
The whole ecosystem?
Yes.
No, you're absolutely right. And so, and why do you do that? Why do you do so much? You do a lot of community service. Why do you do that? Why do you do community service? Personally.
Well, it's a...
Did your mother twist your arm? Did your father twist your arm and say you had to do this?
That's part of it. but it's mostly because it feels really good to help people and to better whatever you can.
To help people, to form partnerships with them. You know, I remember that story about the six-year-old girl on the Mescalero Apache reservation in New Mexico who we had done some community service with, and we asked her that question. She says, well, it puts a glow in my heart. And I thought that was a great, great saying. So now, Emma, you, and at the age of six,
yep,
you had your birthday party, and you decided that you didn't want presents. What did you do? Or you wanted presents, but in a different form, I should say.
Yes. I asked for a small donation to the Heifer Project instead of the regular presents.
And who was the, who did you ask? Your mother and father, or who did you ask for that?
My friends.
Your friends. So the people that came to your party,
yes,
gave a small donation instead of bringing a gift,
mm-hmm,
to clutter up our ecosystem. You got money from that. And how much did you raise from your birth? Do you remember how much you raised at the age of six?
About 150 to 200.
And what could you do with that 150? We're going to talk about the Heifer Project in a minute, but what did you personally do with it?
I saved it. We sent it in the envelope and sent it off to the Heifer. No, we...
You designate you wanted a goat or something? Or
actually, that first year, that was the year that the High School Interact was doing the gift arc.
Oh.
And so we took our money, I think through you, actually, and Scott. And I think I spoke to you about it, and we got the money to the,
that's
kids at
wonderful,
the high school. Right.
The high school, the Millbrook High School, did the Heifer Project, and they wanted to raise $5,000, which was for what they call an ARC, which is like two of every kind of animal, water buffalo, goats, cows, I'm trying to remember all the different animals, chickens.
Oh, they do sheep and
sheep
chicken.
And
they even do honeybees.
Honeybees, yeah, all the different kinds of animals you think about, and that's what $5,000 did. Now, Emma, we're going to go back to the Heifer Project, but just talk about your birthdays for a minute. So do you continue that today? So every birthday,
yep,
you've done the Heifer Project?
Yes, I have for the past.
So you have no toys or anything in your house?
Nope.
No
I
clothes?
I get some from my parents.
Oh, okay. So the parents are exempt.
Yep.
And the toys get bigger and more expensive every year.
But Emma's a wonderful person. I've been so impressed by that story when you were 6 years old and decided to give to the Heifer Project. Now, let's talk about the Heifer Project. What is the Heifer Project?
Well, it's an international organization that raises money to give animals to less fortunate people who might need them. And they teach them how to care and use for the animals. And the great thing about the Heifer Project is eventually when the animals give birth, the families have to give the offspring to other families in their community that might need it.
Great. And we're going to explore a story about that when we come back from Presidential Brainiac. Now, since you are a Brainiac, I assume, since you're such a wonderful community, and you can answer these questions or your mother and father can answer the questions.
Okay.
We'll let JP answer if he knows. So the first question, which party passed the Alien and Sedition Acts as a way of punishing those who supported Thomas Jefferson's Democratic Republicans, especially French and Irish immigrants?
Hmm.
You studied that in school, didn't you? That's your history lesson. You
Whigs?
The Federal, no, it's Federalist. The Federalist Party. Yeah.
Federalist,
yeah.
Okay.
Okay, Janet and Gary knew that. The tactic backfired as Thomas Jefferson was elected president 2 years after the acts were passed in 1800. So two more. Let's see. What election marked the first time a party officially nominated a candidate for president?
I think it was the second one. I think it was Jefferson.
I think it was third.
Adams. Yeah, it would have been Adams.
Well, in 1804, the Democratic Republican congressman held a nominating caucus and named Thomas Jefferson their candidate. So you were partially right. Jefferson went on to receive the 162 electoral votes in a landslide victory over Charles Pinckney of the Federalist Party. Now, that was 162 electoral votes. Now, there's over 2,000.
Oh, yeah, there's like
thousands now.
Well, no, there's about 400 and something. You need 270 to...
Well, then the Democratic, in the primaries, there are more, right?
No, there's no electoral votes in the primaries.
Not electoral votes, I'm sorry, but nominated. Okay, so who is the last question? Who is the only president to have never been elected president or even vice president?
Well, that's easy.
Dr. Gary knows.
That would be Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford is correct.
That's it.
Ford was appointed vice president under the rules of the relatively new 25th Amendment when Spiro Agnew resigned and president when Richard Nixon resigned. Now, I have a special one just for Emma.
Oh, this is about Elvis.
This is about Elvis, although it does start with an E.
Okay.
What did they do? This is a question, Emma, on what did they do. Now, Elizabeth Blackwell, she was born in England and had a private tutor. In 1832, her family moved to the United States, where her father became involved in social reform, much like you're doing. Her application was approved by a consensus of students who thought it was a joke, and she was first in her class in January of 1849.
Mm-hmm.
What did she do?
She was the first woman to graduate from medical school in the United States.
That is absolutely correct. Now, we have a brilliant scholar here.
Oh, yes.
and in a day when women doctors were unheard of, Blackwell was accepted into the medical school at New York's Geneva College only because the administration couldn't come up with a rational reason for excluding her. So, and now we'll go back to our Rotary break, and here's Rotary.
In 1985, while polio was paralyzing 1,000 children a day, Rotary International committed to a goal of ending polio worldwide. Very soon now, after contributing nearly $600 million and immunizing over 2 billion children, the goal will be achieved. Eradicating polio worldwide. That is humanity in motion. That is Rotary.
Scott.
Oh, thank you. And now we're back, and we're going to talk with Emma a little bit more about the Heifer Project, and then we're going to talk to Janet about Junior Interact and how you can form a Junior Act in your school. So Emma, let's go back to the Heifer Project, and, mm-hmm. and you've already told us that you can purchase items through the Heifer Project, and then you give them to a community that needs them. It's not just outside the United States. We also give some to the people in the United States, and I think there's trees. You can buy trees, and they get planted and so on. So now, what's so important about people donating to the Heifer Project? Why, in your opinion, why do you think that people should do this?
Because it's such a variety of ways that can help and benefit those that need it, and it's just a great way to give back. And
great. Now, let me ask you, can you tell me a story about one incident that happened and with a situation like someone getting a goat, for example?
There is a story called Beatrice's Goat, and it is about a girl from Africa, I think, and she doesn't have enough money to go to school, but that's all she really wants. And finally, her mother gets a goat and from the Heifer Project, and she raises enough money from the goat's milk to send her to school.
And so she's now going to school. She has the money by selling the milk to go to school. And what happens to her? She goes to school. What happens after that? Do you know that? Did she become a doctor? She actually became a medical doctor, and she ended up on Oprah.
Oh.
And so, you know, she made it when she... Now, so Emma, you were one of the first people, let's go to Junior Interact, or what the Rotary calls Early Act. You were one of the first people to join this, what we called in Millbrook, Junior Interact.
Right.
And your mother was one of the founders of that organization. And your mother is not a Rotarian. I don't know why not, but she's not a Rotarian. And although she did volunteer for this position, along with Donna Burns, was that right? Donna Burns. Mm-hmm. And the two of them ran this for 3 years, was it?
Yeah, I guess so.
3 years, mm-hmm. and then turned it over to the next group of parents and volunteers. But so what happened in that first year? Can you tell me what Junior Interact even is? So people who are listening have no idea what Junior Interact is.
It's a group in school that works to help out in the community and just does a lot of community service.
Now, you were third, fourth, and fifth grade when you did that? Were you also, was it sixth grade?
Three to six.
Three to six at that time, because now the school is separated, but three to six. So Did you do you remember any of the projects, like Meals on Wheels?
Yes.
Or what did you?
One of them was we prepared food at Grace Church for the Lunchbox, which is a organization who gives makes food for people who can't necessarily afford it for themselves.
So right. So Lunchbox, that's a great one to do. You prepare mm-hmm. the food, and then some others just delivered it on the Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So what? So all these projects, did you think it was a worthwhile idea to get more students involved in this? You were not the only one. How many students were in the group, roughly? 100?
I don't know. I think we regularly had attendance of in the 40 to 50 range.
So 40 to 50.
School of 350, I thought was very good.
That's really good. 350 students. This is third through three. Now, now you're in eighth grade. Are you still in Interact?
Currently not.
Well, because it's summertime, right?
Well, yeah, but I got into sports, but I'm planning on joining in the high school when I have more time.
So in Millbrook, we have three Interacts. We have a junior Interact, which is third, now it's third through fifth, mm-hmm. and we have a middle Interact, which is the sixth grade through eighth grade, and then we have the high school Interact, which is ninth through 12th grade,
right.
And all of them do things. The third through sixth grade, the fifth grade one now, pretty much stays on the school grounds for insurance purposes. The high school one does do things off school grounds. So Emma, do you think that having this Interact is a good thing?
Yes, definitely, I do.
And did you see any of the eyes of the other students that were doing things? Do you have any stories about the other students besides yourself?
They definitely, I know a lot of my friends definitely enjoyed, it was a great way to be with your friends, but also help out.
Good, good. So now, Janet, let's talk to you for a few minutes, the last few minutes, unfortunately.
That's okay.
But what you came to me in the bookstore, in the Merritt Bookstore, you said, I want to set up a community service project. And I said, sure, you're in charge. So what happened
That's
then?
That's your way. Well, I think the key thing was that you brought Donna Burns and I together, the two parents. Of course, Bonnie, her daughter, was also very
she was
interested
terrific, right?
and whatever. And so I guess it hadn't been done before or whatever. So we just thought, well, this is a great idea. So we talked to the principal at the school, and they, gave us some space to work in. The teachers weren't always happy about it, but the principal was great about it and very supportive. And so we just came up with various ideas. You know, Donna had some and I had some, and we put them together.
And did you, what do you think, while you were looking at the students, were they all, what were they getting out of it?
I tell you, that was such a great age to start with, because the kids at that time, they're just so positive and they really want to help people, and they were so enthusiastic about everything that we did. We did projects that were for Meals on Wheels, local projects. We collected school supplies, and shipped them to Thailand to a small school over there where, you know, the kids couldn't afford to go to school. And that was actually through a contact I had at Vassar College. And so we did things like clean up outside. You know, in the spring we'd go out and clean up, and kids would have a lot of fun there, getting all muddy, but cleaning up.
And you came to a few Rotary meetings and explained what was happening.
Yes,
and
as a matter of fact, the woman who had the Thailand connection came to the Rotary meeting
about so there was a good
project.
Relationship.
Yeah.
So right, and Rotary would give a little donation to.
Yes, they did.
So those Rotaries out there that do not have a Early Act or Junior Interact, go ahead and start one. It's a great thing. The school systems love it. And I think yours was always done after school, though, right?
Yes,
you were right after school.
Once a week, I think.
Once a week after school.
Mm-hmm.
So the students just stayed, but then the parents came and picked them up?
Yes.
Afterwards? So then the students would stay for an hour.
Yes.
And then the parents would come or help. Some of the parents actually came and helped, right?
We were dependent on lots of parental help, for sure.
And so be a volunteer, help out. If your child is in a school, start an Interact, a junior Interact, or a middle school Interact. Get this service learning and community service idea going, because it's really, really important. And I think it gives a strong foundation. Emma has it in her, a social conscience already, but it will build social conscience and service learning in other students. And I think it's really important that all students do some sort of service learning or community service, however you want to phrase it. Do you agree with me, Emma, on that? In the last 30 seconds, do you have a question for your father about his topic this morning on threats from above? You have a question, Lee.
Well,
Don't you talk about this over the dinner table? You have
like
10
to
seconds.
Know, why are you such a geek?
Well, that's a great question. Why am I such a geek? It's because I like I like to do science, and science people are sometimes geeks.
Okay.
I do not think that Gary is a geek. I don't even really know what that term is, to be honest with you. I've heard that thrown around. But this is your host, Rotarian Scott Myers, speaking to you from New York's beautiful Hudson Valley and Rotary District 7210. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're listening to the heart and soul of American music, WHVW. It's 12:30.